27. The trial was set for the 20th of June. A week after his Memphis visit, Horace telephoned Miss Reba. "Just to know if she's still there," he said, "so I can reach her if I need to." "She's here," Miss Reba said, "but this reaching, I don't like it. I don't want no cops around here unless they're on my business."
"It'll be only a bailiff," Horace said, "someone to hand a paper into her own hand."
"Let the postman do it, then," Miss Reba said. "He comes here anyway, in a uniform, too. He don't look no worse in it than a full-blowed cop, neither. Let him do it."
"I won't bother you," Horace said. "I won't make you any trouble."
"I know you ain't," Miss Reba said.
Her voice was thin, harsh, over the wire.
"I ain't gonna let you. Minnie's done took a crying spell tonight over that bastard that left her. And me and Miss Myrtle was sitting here, and we got started crying, too. Me and Minnie and Miss Myrtle, we drunk up a whole new bottle of gin. I can't afford that. So don't you be sending no J cops up here with no letters for nobody. You telephone me, and I'll turn them both out on a street, and you can have them arrested there."
On the night of the 19th, he telephoned her again. He had some trouble in getting in touch with her.
"They're gone," she said, "both of them. Don't you read no papers?"
"What papers?" Horace said.
"Hello? Hello?" "They ain't here no more," I said, Miss Reba said. "I don't know nothing about them, and I don't want to know nothing except who's going to pay me a week's room rent on."
"But can't you find where she went to? I may need her."
"I don't know nothing, and I don't want to know nothing," Miss Reba said.
He heard the receiver click. Yet the disconnection was not made at once. He heard the receiver thud onto the table where the telephone sat, and he could hear Miss Reba shouting for Minnie,
"Minnie! Minnie!"
Then some hand lifted the receiver and set it onto the hook. The wire clicked in his ear. After a while, a detached, Delsartish voice said,
"Pine Bluff Descent. Thank you."
The trial opened the next day. On the table lay the sparse objects which the district attorney was offering. The bullet from Tommy's skull, a stoneware jug containing corn whiskey. "I will call Mrs. Goodwin to the stand," Horace said. He did not look back. He could feel Goodwin's eyes on his back as he helped the woman into the chair. She was sworn, the child lying on her lap. She repeated the story as she had told it to him on the day after the child was ill. Twice Goodwin tried to interrupt and was silenced by the court. Horace would not look at him. The woman finished her story. She sat erect in the chair, in her neat, worn gray dress and hat with the darn veil, the purple ornament on her shoulder. The child lay on her lap, its eyes closed in that drugged immobility. For a while her hand hovered about its face, performing those needless maternal actions as though unawares. Horace went and sat down. Then only did he look at Goodwin. But the other sat quietly now, his arms folded and his head bent a little. But Horace could see that his nostrils were waxy white with rage against his dark face. He leaned toward him and whispered, but Goodwin did not move. The district attorney now faced the woman.
"Mrs. Goodwin," he said, "what was the date of your marriage to Mr. Goodwin?"
"I object," Horace said, on his feet.
"Can the prosecution show how this question is relevant?" the court said.
"I waive, Your Honor,"
the district attorney said, glancing at the jury. When court adjourned for the day, Goodwin said bitterly,
"Well, you've said you would kill me someday, but I didn't think you meant it. I didn't think that you—"
"Don't be a fool," Horace said. "Don't you see your case is won? That they are reduced to trying to impugn the character of your witness?" But when they left the jail, he found the woman still watching him from some deep reserve of foreboding. "You mustn't worry at all, I tell you. You may know more about making whiskey or love than I do, but I know more about criminal procedure than you. Remember? You don't think I made a mistake? I know you didn't. Don't you see how that explodes their case? The best they can hope for now is a hung jury. And the chances of that are not 1 in 50. I tell you, he'll walk out of that jail tomorrow a free man. Then I guess it's time to think about paying you. Yes, Morris said. All right. I'll come out tonight. Tonight. Yes. He may call you back to the stand tomorrow. We'd better prepare for it anyway. At 8 o'clock, he entered the madwoman's yard. A single light burned in the crazy depths of the house like a firefly caught in a briar patch, but the woman did not appear when he called. He went to the door and knocked. A shrill voice shouted something. He waited a moment. He was about to knock again when he heard the voice again, shrill and wild and faint as though from a distance, like a reedy pipe buried by an avalanche. He circled the house in the rank, waist-high weeds. The kitchen door was open. The lamp was there, dim in a smutty chimney, filling the room, a jumble of looming shapes, rank with old, foul female flesh, not with light, but with shadow. White eyeballs rolled in a high, tight bullet head in brown gleams above a torn singlet strapped into overalls. Beyond the Negro, the madwoman turned in an open cupboard, brushing her lank hair back with her forearm.
"Your bitch has gone to jail," she said. "Go on with her."
"Jail?" Horace said.
"It's what I said, where the good folks live. When you get a husband, keep him in jail where he can't bother you."
She turned to the Negro, a small flask in her hand.
"Come on, dearie. Give me a dollar for it. You got plenty of money."
Horace returned to town, to the jail. They admitted him. He mounted the stairs. The jailer locked a door behind him. The woman admitted him to the cell. The child lay on the cot. Goodwin sat beside it, his arms crossed, his legs extended in the attitude of a man in the last stage of physical exhaustion. "Why are you sitting there in front of that slit?" Horace said. "Why not get into the corner, and we'll put the mattress over you?" "You come to see it done, did you?" Goodwin said. "Well, that's no more than right. It's your job. You promised I wouldn't hang, didn't you?" "You've got an hour yet," Horace said. "The Memphis train doesn't get here until 8:30." He surely got better sense than to come here in that canary-colored car. He turned to the woman. "But you? I thought better of you. I know that he and I are fools, but I expected better of you." "You're doing her a favor," Goodwin said. "She might have hung on with me until she was too old to hustle a good man. If you'll just promise to get the kid a newspaper grift when he's old enough to make change, I'll be easy in my mind." The woman had returned to the cot. She lifted the child onto her lap. Horace went to her. He said, "You come on now. Nothing's going to happen. He'll be all right here. He knows it. You've got to go home and get some sleep, because you'll both be leaving here tomorrow. Come now." "I reckon I better stay," she said. "Damn it. Don't you know that putting yourself in the position for disaster is the surest way in the world to bring it about? Hasn't your own experience shown you that? Lee knows it. Lee, make her stop this." "Go on, Ruby," Goodwin said. "Go home and go to bed." "I reckon I better stay," she said. Horace stood over them. The woman mused above the child, her face bent and her whole body motionless. Goodwin leaned back against the wall, his brown wrists folded into the faded sleeves of his shirt. "You're a man now," Horace said,
aren't you? I wish that jury could see you now, locked up in a concrete cell, scaring women and children with fifth-grade ghost stories. They'd know you never had the guts to kill anybody.
You better go on and go to bed yourself, Goodwin said. We could sleep here if there wasn't so much noise going on.
No, that's too sensible for us to do, Horace said. He left the cell. The jailer unlocked the door for him, and he quitted the building. In 10 minutes, he returned with a parcel. Goodwin had not moved. The woman watched him open the package. It contained a bottle of milk, a box of candy, a box of cigars. He gave Goodwin one of the cigars and took one himself.
You brought his bottle, didn't you?
The woman produced the bottle from a bundle beneath the cot.
It's got some in it, she said.
She filled it from the bottle. Horace lit his and Goodwin's cigars. When he looked again, the bottle was gone.
Not time to feed him yet, he said.
I'm warming it, the woman said.
Oh, Horace said.
He tilted the chair against the wall, across the cell from the cot.
Here's room on the bed, the woman said. It's softer.
Some. Not enough to change, though, Horace said.
Look here, Goodwin said. You go on home. No use in you doing this.
We've got a little work to do, Horace said. That lawyer will call her again in the morning. That's his only chance to invalidate her testimony some way. You might try to get some sleep while we go over it.
All right, Goodwin said.
Horace began to drill the woman, tramping back and forth upon the narrow floor. Goodwin finished his cigar and sat motionless again, his arms folded and his head bent. The clock above the square struck 9 and then 10. The child whimpered, stirred. The woman stopped and changed it and took the bottle from beneath her flank and fed it. Then she leaned forward carefully and looked into Goodwin's face.
He's asleep, she whispered. Shall we lay him down?
Horace whispered.
No. Let him stay there.
Moving quietly, she laid the child on the cot and moved herself to the other end of it. Horace carried the chair over beside her. They spoke in whispers. The clock struck 11. Still, Horace drilled her, going over and over the imaginary scene. At last, he said,
I think that's all. Can you remember it now?
If he should ask you anything you can't answer in the exact words you've learned tonight, just say nothing for a moment. I'll attend to the rest.
Can you remember now?
Yes, she whispered. He reached across and took the box of candy from the cot and opened it, the glazed paper crackling faintly. She took a piece. Goodwin had not moved. She looked at him, then at the narrow slit of window.
Stop that, Horace whispered.
He couldn't reach him through that window with a hat pin, let alone a bullet. Don't you know that?
Yes, she said.
She held the bonbon in her hand. She was not looking at him.
I know what you're thinking, she whispered.
What?
When you got to the house and I wasn't there, I know what you're thinking.
Horace watched her, her averted face.
You said tonight was the time to start paying you. For a while longer, he looked at her.
Ah, oh, he said, O tempora, O mores, O hell.
Can you stupid mammals never believe that any man, every man? You thought that was what I was coming for? You thought that if I'd intended to, I'd have waited this long?
She looked at him briefly.
It wouldn't have done you any good if you hadn't waited.
What?
Oh, well... But you would have tonight. I thought that was what you would now, then.
She looked around at Goodwin. He was snoring a little. Oh, I don't mean right this minute, he whispered. But you'll pay on demand.
I thought that was what you meant. I told you we didn't have... If that ain't enough pay, I don't know that I blame you.
It's not that. You know it's not that. But can't you see that perhaps a man might do something just because he knew it was right, necessary to the harmony of things that it be done? The woman turned the bonbon slowly in her hand.
I thought you were mad about him.
Lee?
No, him.
She touched the child.
Because I'd have to bring him with us.
You mean with him at the foot of the bed, maybe? Perhaps you holding him by the leg all the time so he wouldn't fall off? She looked at him, her eyes grave and blank and contemplative. Outside, the clock struck 12.
Good
God, he whispered. What kind of men have you known? I got him out of jail once that way. Out of Leavenworth, too, when they knew he was guilty.
You did?
Horace said. Here. Take another piece. That one's about worn out. She looked down at her chocolate-stained fingers and the shapeless bonbon. She dropped it behind the cot. Horace extended his handkerchief.
It'll soil it, she said.
Wait. She wiped her fingers on the child's discarded garment and sat again, her hands clasped in her lap. Goodwin was snoring regularly.
When he went to the Philippines, he left me in San Francisco. I got a job, and I lived in a hall room cooking over a gas jet because I told him I would. I didn't know how long he'd be gone, but I promised him I would, and he knew I would. When he killed that other soldier over that nigger woman, I didn't even know it. I didn't get a letter from him for 5 months. It was just when I happened to see an old newspaper I was spreading on a closet shelf in the place where I worked that I saw the regiment was coming home, and when I looked at the calendar, it was that day. I'd been good all that time. I'd had good chances. Every day I had them with the men coming in the restaurant. They wouldn't let me off to go and meet the ship, so I had to quit. Then they wouldn't let me see him. Wouldn't even let me on the ship. I stood there while they came marching off of it, watching for him and asking the ones that passed if they knew where he was, and them kidding me if I had a date that night, telling me they never heard of him or that he was dead or he had run off to Japan with the colonel's wife. I tried to get on the ship again, but they wouldn't let me. So that night I dressed up and went to the cabarets until I found one of them and let him pick me up, and he told me. It was like I had died. I sat there with the music playing and all, and that drunk soldier pawing at me, and me wondering why I didn't let go on with him, get drunk, and never sober up again, and me thinking... And this is the sort of animal I wasted a year over. I guess that was why I didn't. Anyway, I didn't. I went back to my room, and the next day I started looking for him. I kept on with them telling me lies and trying to make me, until I found he was in Leavenworth. I didn't have enough money for a ticket, so I had to get another job. It took 2 months to get enough money. Then I went to Leavenworth. I got another job as waitress in Child's, night shift, so I could see Lee every other Sunday afternoon. We decided to get a lawyer. We didn't know that a lawyer couldn't do anything for a federal prisoner. The lawyer didn't tell me, and I hadn't told Lee how I was getting the lawyer. He thought I'd save some money. I lived with the lawyer 2 months before I found it out. Then the war came, and they let Lee out and sent him to France. I went to New York and got a job in a munitions plant. I stayed straight, too, with the cities full of soldiers with money to spend, and even the little ratty girls wearing silk. But I stayed straight. Then he came home. I was at the ship to meet him. He got off under arrest, and they sent him back to Leavenworth for killing that soldier 3 years ago. Then I got a lawyer to get a congressman to get him out. I gave him all the money I had saved, too. So when Lee got out, we had nothing. He said we'd get married, but we couldn't afford to. And when I told him about the lawyer, he beat me. Again, she dropped a shapeless piece of candy behind the cot and wiped her hands on the garment. She chose another piece from the box and ate it. Chewing, she looked at Horace, turning upon him a blank, musing gaze for an unhurried moment. Through the slotted window, the darkness came chill and dead. Goodwin ceased snoring. He stirred and sat up. "What time is it?" he said. "What?" Horace said. He looked at his watch. 2:30. "He must have had a puncture," Goodwin said. Toward dawn, Horace himself slept, sitting in the chair. When he waked, a narrow, rosy pencil of sunlight fell level through the window. Goodwin and the woman were talking quietly on the cot. Goodwin looked at him bleakly. "Morning," he said. "I hope you slept off that nightmare of yours," Horace said. "If I did, it's the last one I'll have. They say you don't dream there." "You've certainly done enough not to miss it," Horace said. "I suppose you'll believe us after this." "Believe hell," Goodwin said, who had sat so quiet, so contained, with his saturnine face, negligent in his overalls and blue shirt. "Do you think for 1 minute that man is going to let me walk out of that door and up the street and into that courthouse after yesterday? What sort of men have you lived with all your life? In a nursery? I wouldn't do that myself."
"If he does, he has sprung his own trap," Horace said.
"What good will that do me? Let me tell—"
"Lee," the woman said, "you something.
The next time you want to play dice with a man's neck—"
"Lee," she said. She was stroking her hand slowly on his head, back and forth. She began to smooth his hair into a part, patting his collarless shirt smooth. Horace watched them. "Would you like to stay here today?" he said quietly. "I can fix it." "No," Goodwin said.
"I'm sick of it. I'm going to get it over with. Just tell that goddamn deputy not to walk too close to me. You and her better go and eat breakfast."
"I'm not hungry," the woman said.
"You go on like I told you," Goodwin said.
"Lee, come," Horace said. "You can come back afterward." Outside in the fresh morning, he began to breathe deeply.
"Fill your lungs," he said. "A night in that place would give anyone the Jim Jams. The idea of 3 grown people. My Lord, sometimes I believe that we are all children, except children themselves. But today will be the last. By noon, he'll walk out of there a free man. Do you realize that?" They walked on in the fresh sunlight beneath the high, soft sky. High against the blue, fat little clouds blew up from the southwest, and the cool, steady breeze shivered and twinkled in the locusts where the blooms had long since fallen.
"I don't know how you'll get paid," she said.
"Forget it. I've been paid. You won't understand it, but my soul has served an apprenticeship that has lasted for 43 years. 43 years, half again as long as you have lived. So you see that folly, as well as poverty, cares for its own.
And you know that he, that—"
"Stop it now. We dreamed that away too. God is foolish at times, but at least he's a gentleman. Don't you know that?
I always thought of him as a man," the woman said.
The bell was already ringing when Horace crossed the square toward the courthouse. Already the square was filled with wagons and cars. and the overalls and khaki thronged slowly beneath the Gothic entrance of the building. Overhead, the clock was striking 9 as he mounted the stairs. The broad double doors at the head of the cramped stair were open. From beyond them came a steady preliminary stir of people settling themselves. Above the seatbacks, Horace could see their heads. Bald heads, gray heads, shaggy heads, and heads trimmed to recent feather edge above sun-baked necks, oiled heads above urban collars, and here and there a sunbonnet or a flowered hat. The hum of their voices and movements came back upon the steady draft which blew through the door. The air entered the open windows and blew over the heads and back to Horace in the door, laden with smells of tobacco and stale sweat and the earth, and with that unmistakable odor of courtrooms, that musty odor of spent lusts and greeds and bickerings and bitterness, and withal a certain clumsy stability in lieu of anything better. The windows gave upon balconies close under the arched porticoes. The breeze drew through them, bearing the chirp and coo of sparrows and pigeons that nested in the eaves, and now and then the sound of a motor horn from the square below, rising out of and sinking back into a hollow rumble of feet in the corridor below and on the stairs. The bench was empty. At one side at the long table he could see Goodwin's black head and gaunt brown face and the woman's gray hat. At the other end of the table sat a man picking his teeth. His skull was capped closely by tightly curled black hair thinning upon a bald spot. He had a long, pale nose. He wore a tan Palm Beach suit. Upon the table near him lay a smart leather briefcase and a straw hat with a red and tan band, and he gazed lazily out a window above the ranked heads, picking his teeth. Horace stopped just within the door. "It's a lawyer," he said, "a Jew lawyer from Memphis." Then he was looking at the backs of the heads about the table, where the witnesses and such would be. "I know what I'll find before I find it," he said. "She will have on a black hat." He walked up the aisle. From beyond the balcony window, where the sound of the bell seemed to be, and where beneath the eaves the guttural pigeons crooned, the voice of the bailiff came. "The Honorable Circuit Court of Yucknapatawpha County is now open according to law." Temple had on a black hat. The clerk called her name twice before she moved and took the stand. After a while, Horace realized that he was being spoken to a little testily by the court.
"Is this your witness, Mr. Benbow?"
"It is, Your Honor."
"You wish her sworn and recorded?"
"I do, Your Honor." Beyond the window, beneath the unhurried pigeons, the bailiff's voice still droned, reiterant, importunate, and detached, though the sound of the bell had ceased.